for any new listeners who are listening thanks to the recent Chris Wade appearance, first off, welcome.
How's your ash? How you doing?
Hey, there they are, new listeners. If it's your first or second or third listen, we are a 2000s pop culture podcast, and Giordano needs to clear the air a little bit.
Yeah, so you might be wondering, like, why are you doing another episode on The Sopranos? You've already done The Sopranos. Something I said in our season one episode, which I'll reiterate now, is that The Sopranos, I believe, is the greatest cultural product of the decade. What Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel was for the Renaissance, that's what The Sopranos is for the 2000s. Also, coming to you live on 420, hello, Buona Natale to all those who celebrate the stoner holiday. What kind of animal smokes weed on 420?
Hell yeah. Tony, we also need more Cokes. And what does that smell? What kind of animal smokes marijuana at his own confirmation?
Well, what are you yelling at me for? Even Grandma says the world has no purpose.
Get inside right now and join your guests. Be a good Catholic for 15 fucking minutes. Is that so much to ask?
It's Britney, bitch.
And I rock everywhere like such a...
I'm supposed to be the franchise player, and we're in here talking about practice.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
Out, Charlie! Out!
Our next-door neighbors are foreign countries.
I call upon all nations to do everything they can to stop these terrorist killers.
Thank you.
Now watch this drive.
Bro, I was back in Udine for Easter, and I seem incapable of escaping from the tradition of banging 40-year-old women.
Sorry, what? You found another MILF, Andrea?
I don't know what's wrong with me, why I like them so much, and I don't know why they like me so much.
I can't quite put my finger on it, what it would be about you. Not sure, something about the Madonna.
I don't know what's wrong with me. Why do I end up with older women? I don't know.
It's the mother! It has to do with the mother! Always.
Bullshit.
Okay, let's get down to business. Showtime. Hey, everybody, and welcome to Remember Shuffle. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is my co-host, Giordano.
Commendatore.
I don't think it's a greeting, Giordano.
That's how Paula uses it. Like a commander.
And today, we are joined by second-time returning Remember Shuffle guest, an excellent friend of mine, our chief Italy correspondent, Andrea. Say hi, Andrea.
Hello, everybody. Ciao.
We did an episode on Eat, Pray, Love, which performed okay, mostly because the source material was so fucking god-awful, but Andrea got a lot of love in the comments.
The first time people were ever like, can you give us the Instagram at for your guest?
So we're really excited to have him back on the pod. And we are returning to the well of Sopranos. We recorded one episode limited just to season one of The Sopranos because the show is truly so abundant and gives you so much to talk about that we knew we would have to return to the well, especially since Giordano has cooked his brain on this content. But Giordano, tell me why specifically. What's special? What's amazing about season two?
Well, I actually think we could get warmed up with a few improv exercises.
Oh, no.
You know? Yeah, maybe we could play A and B. Like Chris does in Big Girls Don't Cry.
A.
B. A.
B.
A. Outstanding. A case in point. Words are only words. You just saw two actors have an entire conversation saying only A and the other responding B. Mitch, Christopher, you want to give it a try?
A.
Stop it, Christopher!
But since we're gangsters, we could play A and O instead.
A, O,
O,
A,
O. I don't know what the fuck is going on.
There's an improv scene in Big Girls Don't Cry where Chris does an improv game. And I have always liked to imagine the idea of Chris bringing the improv games back to Satrials to play with the guys in the back. None of these fucking young guys, they don't know how to yes and anymore. Nobody yes ands anymore. They don't add additional information.
It's all no buts.
You're no butting me, Chrissy.
Getting dangerously close to Seinfeld, though.
Well, Sopranos can often be very close to Seinfeld.
Well, Carmela, the guy spends the night here with you, and all he does is slip you a wafer?
That's verging on sacrilege.
Oh, I didn't mean to verge.
But to seriously answer your question, season two, I believe, is very, very good, very magical for a few reasons. One, we discussed in season one that the season-long plot arcs don't really matter. We kind of glossed over them because they're boring. It's more like just blah, 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 who cares, Tony and his uncle. The season two plot arcs are actually incredibly interesting and develop into beautiful climaxes at the end of the season. And as well, I think that there's a thematic through line for the entire entire season that is much more pronounced than in season one. Specifically, I think that this is a season about American existentialism. David Chase, the creator of The Sopranos, has said that he believes the show is about trying to find happiness in an American context. How do you become a happy person when you are living in America in consumerism at the end of history? And so this season very much is a meditation on how to get over ennui. And I think that it's even very prescriptive about how to approach life. Not that Tony takes any of these prescriptions, mind you. And yeah, like I said, it's also about a continuation from last season's discussion. It's about trying to be a gangster at the end of history. Tony is bourgeois and alienated and trying to be a gangster in the third millennium. And we'll see him in this season try to make money in ways that are increasingly disassociated from any kind of familial sphere.
Yeah, the gangsters go corporate because they have to. The gangsters need to change with the times, but we have gotten so far from the romanticism of we're going to defend the little Italian shop from harassment and charge them a bit of protection money, right?
Yeah. And so just to signpost this episode a little bit, we'll start off with a brief description of the season-long plot. Then we'll do a episodic deep dive on three specific episodes, including Commendatori, Big Girls Don't Cry, and then D-Girl. And then we'll talk about our themes of American existentialism and trying to be a gangster at the end of history. And I just wanted to pause for a second to define what I'm talking about when I say that Tony is a gangster at the end of history. So at this time, pre-9/11, late 90s, there's this sense that, you know, we're living at the end of history, meaning we've sort of figured out society and how it should be run. That's why we have so much wealth. That's why things are going so well.
Ladies and gentlemen, we got it.
Ladies and gentlemen, we figured out ideology. But there's this pervasive sense of unease and boredom and unable to comprehend why we aren't happier. I think the year that season two of The Sopranos comes out, the movie that wins Best Picture is American Beauty, which is precisely about this idea. A boomer who lives in a wealthy suburb who suddenly finds himself bored and unhappy and wanting to experience life at a deeper level.
Also, Jordan, let's be real. It won because everyone at the Academy also wants to fuck a high schooler.
I think that clearly that was what was going on. They were like, this movie finally is what's going on in my head.
It's like how George Michael on Arrested Development really liked Les Cousins Dangereux.
Like the way they think.
And Tony feels the same way. I mean, he explicitly says, if things are going so well, why do I want to rip the phone out of the wall?
Out of any fucking scale you want to use, things are going good. I'm firmly in charge. No trouble there. My family is healthy. Right? So why the fuck am I ripping phones out of the wall in front of my kid and screaming at my sister all the fucking time, although she is totally unimportant to me?
You got a lot on your mind.
Because I'm the boss. See, that's the point. You never saw Douglas MacArthur going around punching fucking walls. What if I told you I went to see a shrink? Every once in a while I get anxious, you know, just in general. No reason. It's like I'm in my kitchen. All of a sudden I can't breathe, right? It's like I'm suffocating. I get to the point where I fucking pass out.
He says, I'm richer than my parents were. I'm richer than I've ever been. And yet I'm unhappy. I feel empty and I don't feel connected to anything. That's what I mean when I say he's a gangster at the end of history.
It is kind of funny to me that the original end of history essay is published in 1989. And it takes us 10 years of peace and prosperity to go to like Fight Club levels of malaise. Like, I'm fucking pissed off.
Sweet. And I don't know why I live in the perfect economic system.
Why am I so angry?
Why do I want to break stuff?
Yeah, turns out, and this is true, people need meaning outside of the fucking profit motive.
The GDP growth last year was 4%, and yet I still feel upset. What the fuck is going on?
The Gini coefficient, the HDI index, it's all great. Why do I feel so bad?
So, first season-long plot arc is the Davey Scatino bust out. We learn a lot in this season about how Tony makes money. I counted 8 to 10 different money-making schemes this season. And a lot of them are traditional mafia-related ones, things like gambling, loan sharking, hookers, protection money, stolen cars, union racketeering, waste management, pornography, safe-cracking. But a lot of decidedly more modern schemes that feel more at home in the 21st century. He's taking advantage of globalization with a calling card scam. He's intimidating the algorithm of finance with the Webistics pump and dump. He's infringing on intellectual property with selling bootleg DVDs. But Tony does describe the bust out as his bread and butter, which is a man runs up a gambling debt to Tony, someone who is quite bored with life and wanting to find a way to add some kind of excitement to his boring domesticated American life, and runs up a $45,000 debt with Tony. I did the math on this, and I'll put the math in the show notes.
Nerd!
Based on some retail data. And I think that Tony probably made about $175,000 out of him by doing the bust out.
Damn.
And so what you do with the bust out is you find someone who owns a business, and then once they're in debt to you, what you do is you basically just steal all the inventory at their store. You sell it for like 10 to 20 cents on the dollar to your friends and family and neighbors. And then because they have a credit line with their store, you can get like 6 months worth of inventory on their credit line and sell that for 10 to 20 cents on the dollar. I'll move on to the second season long plot arc then, which is sibling conflict. Janice is Tony's sister, and she has come back to New Jersey from California.
Jordano, please don't dead name her. Her name is Parvati.
Right. Okay. Right. Yes. That's true. Yeah. Janice is the show trying to dunk on a character with a hippie sensibility. You know, she's moved out west. She's converted to some kind of Eastern religion. She's changed her name to Parvati. She's eating tofu.
Yeah. I fucking love the character of Janice. In that same way that a character on screen who's so good that it makes you feel like Tony feels. I feel so angry and frustrated with Janice all the time. Because, yeah, she's flaky. She's not just a stereotype of a hippie. She is an Inception double level stereotype. Imagine the stereotype of someone from the Northeast, right? They're mean. They're blunt. They're all business. And then imagine what that stereotype thinks about someone from California. And that is Janice. A stereotype of a stereotype. She's also got the Rolling Stones lift tattooed on her titty, which rocked.
Yeah, with a sprinkle of New York University student vibe.
Yeah, well, because she is a person from the Northeast who's trying to be like a California hippie, but she's such a shallow person to begin with that even when she tries to ape another culture, she can only get the most shallow understanding of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like Lizzie Gilbert moving to Italy and saying, I'm Italian now because I say attraversiamo.
Yes. Yeah, in our last episode, Chris Wade mentioned that his variation of the old saying that every story can be boiled down to a man comes to town or a man leaves town is you either need to fight your dad or find a new dad. And season two of The Sopranos is great because it features both of those. Towards the end of season one, Tony Soprano tries to fight his mother by smothering her with a pillow. And in season two, he needs to get a new mother. And of course, because he is Italian, it is a mother instead of a father.
Yeah, so in this case, it's both of Chris's descriptions, right? It's like a woman comes to town, Janice, and becomes his new mother. So the other sibling character that re-enters the picture this season is the deceased boss of the family from last season, Jackie Aprile. His brother, Richie Aprile, has been released from prison. He's been rehabilitated and creates a lot of friction with Tony. He's older, he's a psycho, he's old school, he doesn't really fit into this new mafia system.
He's incredibly unsettling. He's a terrifying villain, and he's an amazing presence to add to the show. He honestly kind of reminded me of Anton Chigurh from No Country for Old Men, because he's got the dead shark eyes and the weird haircut.
Yeah, Tony calls him Manson Lamps, his eyes.
He's a wonderful sociopath, which I admire.
Yes. Yeah.
I stand by my comments on our first season episode that generally, whenever they have a non-Italian actor on this show, they're some of the best actors because you could tell they couldn't find an Italian one that fit. And they're like, okay, fine, we'll take a non-Italian one. David Preval is Jewish and he's so good. He's so scary and also funny. It's so hard to be scary and funny. I wouldn't say Anton Chigurh is that funny.
What's this?
What's this? It's the jacket.
The jacket.
The jacket.
And I just think it's really interesting because Tony, I think, is kind of a bad manager. We start to get the sense in the second season that Tony is too much of a boomer. Like, he's always bemoaning that no one is old school anymore. Everyone is a fucking rat. And then he gets this guy who is old school, literally went to jail for 10 years and didn't rat. And his immediate reaction is to push him away and be hostile to him and eventually have to kill him.
Yeah, Richie Aprile is like the mosquito stuck in amber. Right? He's everything that Tony says and thinks that he wants. Then he actually meets him. And he's like, oh yeah, fuck this, right? This is not what he wants at all. Tony, it's so funny that he's in therapy. He's like the worst therapy patient. You say he's like a bad manager. And I think you're right. Because part of being a manager is to not let your emotions control you. And also to kind of recognize other emotions in other people, I think is part of being a good manager and or leader. And Tony cannot do either. He always just slips out to a 10 or an 11 for anything.
And I mentioned that Tony decides to kill kill Richie, which isn't actually what happens. In classic Sopranos fashion, what would become sort of a trademark for the series is anticlimax. What happens is, right after Tony decides to kill Richie, Janice kills Richie in a domestic dispute. And Janice is Tony's other foe this season. And so it's something David Chase always says he tried to do with his series was have the thing that you're expecting to happen, happen, but in an unexpected way. He always thought that that was a very satisfying way to tell a story. Just one more note that Janice, she stepped into Livia's shoes this season. Livia was the point of all Tony's emotional conflict last season, his mother driving him insane. And Janice has occupied her house and car and gets on his nerve the same way Livia did last season. Tony doesn't speak to Livia until the last episode of the season this year, or the second last episode. The one final season long arc before we move into our episode deep dive is that Big Pussy is back, and Big Pussy is a big rat. He's a snitch. He's wearing a wire. He's trying to get information on Tony. And Chase said he actually didn't originally intend for this to be the focus of the season, but between season one and two, fans kept asking him, where's Pussy? Where's Pussy? Is he a rat? So we figured, oh, I do kind of have to follow up with this storyline and see where it goes. As a result, I do think it's some of the weaker stuff in the season, to be honest. But I think probably for first-time fans, this is pretty interesting. Pussy's in a tough spot. He has two kids in college at Villanova, and college is expensive in America, so he's had to start selling heroin to afford their college tuition.
And let me be clear, I want to be 100%, you know, this is an independent show. I'm not censored. I can say what I truly believe. Dealing heroin is morally superior to doing literally any job at a university. We're comparing work to work here.
And the season ends with Funhouse, the episode, which is very much a David Lynch-inspired dream sequence in which Tony is working through his subconscious. And you feel like his work with Melfi is actually helping him and leading him somewhere. Tony is able to slowly decode his dream and his subconscious to realize that Pussy is the threat. Eventually just having his subconscious come out and tell him that Pussy is working with the government. And there's a lot of fun details in these dream sequences that make these incredibly fun to rewatch. The fact that Tony has two meals, one Italian and one foreign, and it's the Italian one that makes him sick. And he determines that the problem is not in his head when he wakes up in the middle of the night, it's in his gut. It's something he feels on a subconscious level more than at a conscious one.
You know, I've been working with the government, right, Tom? Anyway, $4 a pound.
One thing that I absolutely love about this show, to put this in therapy terms, I have some ambivalent feelings about therapy. It probably doesn't hurt and it might help, but we have overcorrected. Everybody's in fucking therapy, and I love that the show is framed around therapy and the emotions and whatever, but it also takes the opportunity to dunk on therapy, especially in those scenes when Dr. Melfi goes to see her therapist and the nonsense that they spout to one another, where she's like, I said toodaloo, I regressed into a childlike state. It's clear that the show is winking, being like, yeah, this is kind of bullshit.
And what's fascinating is that this all happened 25 years ago, and I feel like we were not even close to the kind of situation we have right now, where everybody is in fucking therapy of some sort, right? And how about self-diagnose? You know, everybody diagnoses whatever the fuck, like, everybody has ADHD. What the fuck is that?
Oh, yeah, Andre, you know we're an anti-ADHD pod.
Yeah, but as a person who suffers from panic attacks and stuff like that, I know a thing or two about this kind of issue. And I've just realized, it occurred to me a couple of days ago, because I do a lot of intense thinking. And I just realized, you know what? Maybe I should just man the fuck up. You know what? It's not about therapy. I feel like, you know, it's about be a fucking man or a woman or whatever you want to be, right? But just be it, right? I'm getting so fucking tired. Everybody's in therapy and everybody's so fucking miserable. So is that working? I'm not so sure. Go to the gym. Do something else. Go steal. You know, stealing from shops. That's beneficial. I highly recommend it, right? Do something that makes you feel alive.
I love that you said be a man or a woman or whatever. It's like, whatever happened to Barry Cooper? Now there was an envy.
But yeah, like the psychiatrization of society is something that I really, even on a political level, I'm highly skeptical about it.
Oh, yeah. Why do center-left politicians have to say, we see you, we hear you, you're valid, right? That's so therapy pilled.
Yeah.
Politics is supposed to be about power. Who has it, how they wield it, and for whom? Why are you telling me my feelings are valid? Get me healthcare!
If you think about it, everything goes back to the fucking individual. The only possible horizon of understanding this general sadness that permeates us all, right? Mm-hmm. It's always about the fucking individual. And I'm like, you know what? I don't think so. I don't want to bring up Mark Fisher or stuff like that, but I realized that my very own depression and anxiety, I'm like, you know what? This world sucks. And it's not necessarily because of something that happened to me when I was a child, right?
Wow, Andrea, coming out with a very hot take here. I feel like between me on the Paris Hilton episode saying that ADD is made up despite the fact that I take Adderall every day, and Andrea saying that therapy is garbage despite the fact that he's had a panic attack, this show is starting to have like the ideological consistency of a Red Scare episode.
Or like Tony Soprano himself in therapy. Okay, so let's do a deep dive into a handful of episodes. Let's start with the episode that inspired it all, Commendatori.
Commendatori, like a commander. Okay, so this episode is about romanticization of Italy. You have these characters. It opens with them watching The Godfather on DVD.
To get prepared, to do your homework before you go to the old country.
They are psyched to live up this fantasy that they've had. They've never been to Italy. They think of themselves as Italian. It's something that's extremely important to them.
So important that they refuse to learn the language.
And yeah, I just think that this is like a very common experience in America for a lot of different type of Americans. Irish Americans are like this for sure. Italians are the worst culprits of this kind of thinking.
For some reason, the German Americans don't do a similar thing. I wonder why not. Yeah. I wonder what could have happened.
And Tony thinks he's going to go over there and feel like he's in The Godfather, right? Mm-hmm. And what happens is that when he pulls up to Annalisa's house, for example, they're even playing very Godfather-inspired music. And when then he gets to the front, it's this very kind of tacky and modern house. There's rap music playing from inside.
Lo scandalo.
Yeah. And same thing happens with Pauly, where for different reasons, Pauly is just as turned off by Italy. Although he convinces himself that he loves it because he's a moron, but he's a happy moron. He's the happy wanderer. Pauly just wants macaroni and gravy. That happened actually to the real Tony Sirico. So that guy, I've talked about him on the pod, just how much I love Tony Sirico. When he showed up in Italy, he doesn't like any pasta al dente. And so he would send it back 5 or 6 times going, mushy, 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 mushy. I want the macaroni more mushy.
Oh my God.
Yeah, Andrea, what do you think of these people, Americans who go back to Italy and don't speak the language and find that it's not the storybook place that they think it's
going to be? Yeah, so I've got to say that this speaks to me on a highly personal level. And my mom is Sicilian, right? And so like every Sicilian, like, you know, we do have relatives on the East Coast in Connecticut, right? I had the chance to meet up and become friends with my family over there in Connecticut, my cousin Carmelo, right? And so I experienced what this kind of Italian-American culture and identity is all about. And the setting of Connecticut is somehow similar to New Jersey, I would say, right? I mean, it's a little more polished, perhaps, but still the kind of dynamics are the same. Basically, what happened is that in the 50s, right, my Dio Paolo, he left Sicily when he was 12 years old after the war, right? And he only came back to Sicily for 40 years. He never came back. Never, ever. And so I've always been fascinated by how strong and intense this sense of Italian identity, how they feel it, how they live it, and how, I don't want to sound like, you know, I mean, fuck academia, right? But still, identity are constructs, right? And like, I never quite realized it before hanging out with my American relatives, right? And I say this with the utmost respect. I'm not giving Italianness licenses here.
Gatekeeping the concept of Italianness. One of the fascinating differences is that Italy is so fucking regional. Like, Andrea, you've said to me before, you are only Italian during the Euros and the World Cups. Every other part of the year, you're Friulian.
Yeah, exactly, right? So, yeah, because my father is from the very far north. Like, I would say that Italy is, among the countries that I know, internally, perhaps the most diverse.
But yeah, I think when Italians came over here, it all got flattened into this particular, like, new new identity that exists only over here. And this is played for laughs in The Sopranos, where the part of Italy where they're from has seafood pasta.
Yep.
Yeah, they get squid ink pasta, and like, that didn't make it over here. That's one of the dishes that got left behind over there. And that's one of the points of contention between Paulie and the Italians. So like, we have this funny thing where even the conception of what Italian food is wrapped up in Italian-Americanness, and it's not all of the different kinds of regional cuisine and whatnot that exist over there in the old country.
And I will mention too that Tony does get a little glimpse of what he wants, which I think is very true to life, that you'll have these expectations that are very romantic and you'll find that they come up short, but you will get a glimpse of the thing you were looking for. And there's that scene where Tony is speaking to Annalisa, the one where the street dog runs up to the two of them and she's surrounded by her family. They're eating food together. And for like a moment, he gets a taste of that thing he's looking for. And I had a very similar experience to Tony where my dad's family is from Friuli and I went back there. And of course, it's awkward. You don't speak the same language as these people. I mean, I'm an idiot. I don't speak Italian. And it is funny too, because they've become so American too. Like, I remember I was staying in my cousin's room and they had the OC posters all over the wall. But you do get a little glimpse of it. You know, they all live next to each other, like Annalisa's family. The dad had a house and the two daughters had houses on either side of him. Despite your expectations coming up short, you can eventually find a sliver of what you're looking for.
And I think we said this on our first episode. It's so fucking funny. Like, you could keep having family barbecues, dude. You
yes.
could keep doing this.
Yeah, no, you just become too American. The world is too alienating that you just decide to stop. Even though, yeah, nothing is stopping you from getting the family together every Sunday or going to church or whatever it is you think you want to do. Anyway, just to wrap up our discussion of this episode, generally people say that this is one of the weaker episodes of The Sopranos. It's mostly for technical reasons. The A and B and C plots don't really tie together at all, only on the shallowest terms. This idea that women in Italy are powerful, but Carmela doesn't feel powerful. And then also, this is one of the funniest episodes to watch the director's commentary for on the DVDs, because they just discuss how difficult it was working in Italy. They said it's awesome to be in Naples, but everything is behind schedule constantly. He said the Italian actors would just start singing and they had to have everything translated to them. So that thing of like Tim Van Patten, the director, was actually yelling at them, Wilshire Boulevard, which is the line that he's trying to get Don Vittorio to say.
Don Vittorio, it's an honor.
Wheelchair, a boulevard.
Think, something's wrong with the wheelchair.
So also technically it's not great too, because they were always behind schedule. They couldn't get good coverage, which means getting the scene from a bunch of different camera angles to tell it like in a more nuanced way. And so often they're doing very basic tableau camera shots of the scene. So yeah, that's why usually this episode is considered not the best. But I mean, I disagree, just because it's so much fun seeing these guys' expectations of Italy come up short.
Yeah, because they're morons, right? Yeah. I would also add one thing I love from this episode is that Chrissy, what does Chrissy do when he goes to Italy? You have all the beauty, the architecture.
Yeah, wants to go to the volcano, right?
Yes! Yeah,
and then the topless beaches.
Right? Yes! Yeah. And what does he do? He just does heroin in a room. Come on, we got heroin at home. We got flop houses at home. Yeah, it's honestly kind of tragicomic, the Chrissy storyline on this one. The other thing I wanted to say about Commendatore, and just again, this Italian-American versus Italian or Irish-American versus Irish angle, in terms of what it has to do with politics. Like, Andrea, I remember you were scandalized when you were over stateside by how apolitical students could be, graduate students. In Italy, students organize because it's a real society with real politics and people organize for goals and whatnot. But I think it is so fucking funny that Italian Americans and Irish Americans, we tend to imagine them as trending kind of right wing, question mark, if you're in the suburbs of Boston or suburbs of New York or Long Island or whatever. And like, look at the Irish in Palestine right now, right? That's a country full of comrades right now. It's one of the only European countries whose government itself, not just its people, is loudly and proudly pro-Palestine. And you look at the Irish-American South Boston cops that we got, and you're like, man, what? Yeah. Something happened.
That makes it a very good case for how American identity works, right? The migrant communities, Italians and Irish, Russians, right? That great movie with Robert De Niro, like, you know, the the hunter. I mean, il cacciatore, I know it in Italian. He hunts fucking deers. The deer hunter, right? I'm sorry. These migrant communities, they seem to retain some of the peculiar aspects of the country they come from, right? They pump it up with steroids, while at the same time, they adhere a lot ideologically to what America is all about, right? So they can be the most overly nationalistic, chauvinistic, ultra-Americans, right? While at the same time pretending to be something else, which is very fascinating if you think about it. Like, how does that work? It's great, I think. The social phenomenon in the history of the country, right? The development of America in the 20th century. I used to go often to Connecticut, and specifically, I used to hang out at a only Italian club in New Haven. It's called like Campania Club, founded in 1913 or something like that. Mm. So very, very old, right? I can guarantee that the least fascist-leaning person was probably... I mean, Donald Trump would be somebody reasonable within that kind of... With all due respect, obviously, right? These are great people that I had a great time with, right? But still, I was like, damn, these are not just Republicans. These are hardcore Republicans.
Right.
Basically, all of them. All of them. So we're talking about some 50, 60 males, different ages. So from 20 to 80,000, right? And dude, it was really impossible to find someone talking about politics, someone that I would feel like, all right, he's on my side, right? Not really.
Big Silvio Berlusconi fans over there.
Yeah, right.
All right, let's take a quick pause to get Alex on the mic, and then we'll go to our next episode.
Yeah, big girls don't cry.
Come, look what's this. Oh. Come here. Oh.
Yes, we're going to be joined by a fourth Mike. We're also bringing in another Soprano super fan and returning guest of the pod, Al from Brooklyn. Say hi.
How you doing?
I have a little special surprise for us. I actually have a fifth person joining us this week. I didn't tell you about this, guys, but a good friend of mine is joining us for this episode. So why don't you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Mitch McDermott, born and raised in Hartsdale, but please don't hold that against me. Right now, I'm on the sales team down at Chick Brower, Porsche Audi.
All right, thank you. Yeah, good friend of mine.
Fuck off. Okay, so Big Girls Don't Cry, deep dive episode number 2. This is a great episode because this is very therapy-pilled. This is about dealing with your emotions. In this episode, Tony has rage-a-hall. He's not in therapy and he's flipping out. He's flying off the handle at the smallest little slights. He destroys the home phone in the kitchen really early in the episode in front of his son as he's getting ready for school. And it's a big problem. We see Tony struggle. He goes to Hesh and tries to use him, his friend, as a surrogate therapist. Just starts dumping all of his problems on him. And Hesh is both not qualified and also not interested. They're very, very funny scenes where they're just talking beyond one another. It is a great screen cap answer for who needs a therapist when you have friends. Like, this is how your friends do it when you try and just dump your therapy shit on them.
Yeah, they're like, I'm not interested in hearing about your dreams.
Yeah, true. Chris is dealing with his sadness. He joins an improv class and he literally gets triggered by a scene in which he has to act out an intimate, vulnerable relationship with his father, and he gets triggered by the fact that his father died when he was so young, and rather than sit and feel these feelings, he punches a guy at his class.
Yeah, and Chris, this is what ties the A and B plot together in this episode, is we have two guys who are trying to hold back their emotions unsuccessfully and using other things as therapy, using things that aren't therapy as therapy. So Tony using humor, deflection, his friend, his Uma. Chris is using this acting class. And Chris, very interesting in this episode, because anytime he feels the least bit vulnerable and starts to experience expressing himself, he reacts violently. He does a line of coke at the first time he starts to have some kind of expression. And then in one of the last scenes of the episode, he punches Mitch in the face because he tapped into something, feelings about his father.
And then we also have the third little plot. This is where what I was saying about the show Donkey on Therapy, we see Dr. Melfi trying to reconcile her feelings. She wants to treat Tony. She's having dreams about him dying in car accident, and she is the only one who is in therapy, but her feelings, like she feels some kind of attraction to Tony, or maybe she's titillated by the mob life. She likes to live a little bit on the edge, and she has big I can fix him energy, and rather than wrestle with the fact that part of her is attracted to this violent sociopathic man, she's going to bottle up and avoid her emotions by being like,
I can fix it.
Yeah, she says, that could be therapy for me, giving therapy to Tony Soprano.
It could be therapeutic, which is so fucking funny.
So one thing I want to focus on in this episode is something that we did as an exercise for season one for the episodes we talked about, which is talking about the connective tissue, as Soprano's Autopsy puts it, which is an excellent website, that ties all of the small details together in with the entire theme of this episode. So David Chase has said that God is in the details. And once again, if you look at any small detail in this episode, you'll see that it fits the episode's theme extremely well, right? So Tony meets with Polly at the Lou Costello Park in this episode, a famous Italian-American physical comedian who uses violence for comedy. And this episode features violence that is dressed up in comedy often, but also violence that is just so horrific that it doesn't seem very funny at all. And I think it's commenting on the way that The Sopranos plays with this.
Yeah, and even the statue of Costello, he has a baseball bat in the statue, which we will see when Furio goes to get his money from the fucking rub and tug parlor. He smashes it up with a bat. That's like his weapon.
Yes. Chris breaks his foot kicking Mitch in this episode, which I think is interesting because the physical pain doesn't bother him that much. It's the emotional pain that bothers him. But Chris also, Michael Imperioli, gets shot in the foot in Goodfellas.
Well, it's not what Mitch said. It's how he said it.
How he said it. Yes. A big part of what we're going to talk about later with this idea of American existentialism is how do we assign meaning to things that don't necessarily have to matter. And I think another through line for this episode too is this idea that holding back your emotions is something that comes with an expectation of growing up, of moving past childhood and being an adult, right? So Chris does a scene from Rebel Without a Cause, which is a coming of age story. The title of this episode is Big Girls Don't Cry. It's like sort of explicitly saying this. Melfi says of Tony, he can be such a little boy sometimes. And there's a lot of imagery that just suggests that one of the things about growing up is that you have to learn to control your emotions.
Giordano, as anyone who's been to therapy will tell you, you can't control your emotions. You gotta passively observe. You gotta do mindfulness. You gotta journal.
Can I tell you something?
Please, Andrea.
Yeah, so I've changed career path. So I'm no longer a wannabe university professor anymore. I saw light, like St. Paul on the way to Damascus. And so I was at the office. I work in something. I mean, I don't know. What is consultancy? I don't know. But I do something like that, right? Which is funny. So yeah, I was doing whatever I was doing, right? Sitting on my desk with my laptop, right? And at some point, these two girls from the HR department, and I was like, I'm not interested, right? They wanted to give me some fucking stickers. And I'm like, no, I don't want the sticker. Like, I'm working, right? And they were like, you know, but this is for mental health. And so I was like, listen, you know what? I defeated mental health, right? So please, can I go back to what...
Andrea, what were your strategies? What worked best to defeat mental health?
Alcohol.
Actually, you're sort of quoting Lizzie Gilbert from Eat, Pray, Love when she holds the glass of wine and says, in America, this is how we say therapist.
Yeah.
All right, let me teach you a word. Therapist. Therapist. Come on, cheers.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that movie has been so central in my life, and I realized it since, you know, until today.
Yeah, so just to finish up on Big Girls Don't Cry, I'll just mention first episode by Terrence Winter, written by Terrence Winter, who would go on to make Boardwalk Empire, one of the key writers on The Sopranos. It's also the second episode directed by Tim Van Patten, who would go on to direct the first few episodes of Game of Thrones. And if you check out that fight scene at the end of Big Girls Don't Cry, when Furio goes into the tanning salon, it's pretty expertly directed.
Filmed on a handheld camera, you were telling me.
Yes, like, by him.
Yeah.
Dude, if you want to see what a shakedown should look like,
yes,
you call Furio Giunta and you send him in there with a fucking bat and he'll handle the situation, let me tell you.
Yes, Chris half commits to his shakedown. He puts the paintbrush up the guy's nose, but Furio shows you what full commitment.
He literally kneecaps a guy, dude. The guy paid with his fucking kneecaps.
Also, one of my favorite small throwaway lines, speaking of God is in the details, when they're discussing shaking down this massage parlor, a bunch of like Polly and all the gangsters, they're being kind of racist about the wife of the owner, and one of the gangsters has to chime in and say, she's not Chinese, she's Filipina.
Yeah, she's a Filipino. Gigi. Yeah.
Are you Chinese or Japanese?
A great little touch.
So we'll move on to D-Girl. Many people say this is the worst episode of the season. I think it's probably because it's the most easy to understand. So this is the one, I think, when I was first watching this as a teenager, where I was like, oh, I actually get this one. And I don't have to read Soprano's Autopsy to get it. So you have three people in this episode who are doing some kind of confirmation. Chris needs to confirm that he wants to stay with the mafia and not become a Hollywood guy. AJ needs to do his literal confirmation with the Catholic Church, which is a Catholic ritual in which, you know, you're born Catholic and you're baptized, but you don't really have a say in it. And so as a teenager, you have to confirm as an adult that this is something I'm actually interested in and wasn't just chosen for me. The irony of this usually is that you're pressured by your parents and your school to do it.
Yeah, and you're 13 years old. It's like, yeah, you're old enough to consent now. 13-year-old child.
What was everybody's confirmation name, by the way?
I chose the name Alphonse.
Yeah.
Because technically you could add the confirmation name as an extra initial if you wanted to. And that would make my initials Bean. B-E-A-N.
Nice. You said you can call me Al.
What was yours, Tornado? I happen to remember it, but say it for the listeners. What was your confirmation name?
It was Falk.
F-U-L-K.
F-U? I never got my confirmation, so I...
You never did in Italy?
No, because...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because I lost faith when I was very young, and my parents, they're leftists, so they don't care too much.
I see.
Okay. Yeah, side note for the Irish, who are like, the Catholic Church is humane and good. You should really look at what they might have been up to in Italy in the 50s through 80s. And reevaluate that position in Italy, the whole Catholicism, the Catholic Church's role in particularly Cold War politics is perhaps a little different.
And that's not even pedophile stuff, listener. That's this is a different, yeah, like this is a different kind of crime that Al is referencing. Sometimes, you know, Andrea said you should steal things from stores to get a rush and feel alive. Sometimes, if you're the Catholic Church, the pedophilia just isn't hidden anymore, and you need to engage in some light terrorism.
So Pussy needs to confirm that he will be an informant. He will be working with the FBI and not with the mafia. So they were going through three confirmations here. It's also a great episode because Chris is in the movie business. He's working with Jon Favreau, who makes an appearance in this episode.
An amazing performance. Laughing at himself a little. I know this episode has his haters because it doesn't have a lot of gangster content, but the send-up of Hollywood is so fucking good, man.
I've said it once, I'll say it again. The Sopranos, when they do their best lampooning of a type of guy, they're best at making fun of themselves because they know themselves. And so when they're making fun of yuppies or people in the film industry, they are at their most biting. And the way that Amy Shafir and Jon Favreau talk is so funny.
So good.
It's pretentious. Yeah. Everything relates to a movie. The best line, I think, is their silencers underscore their place in society, which is like what we do on this podcast. It's so good. Yeah. I felt very seen by that line.
Yes.
There's just some great dunks on yuppies in this season as a whole. There's this great scene where this guy witnesses Tony do a murder and he's like, oh, I'm going to do the right thing. And, I'm gonna go to the police. And then once his wife finds out that the guy he saw do a crime was Tony, he flips out. And just the tableau of this yuppie couple in their living room, I think he's reading Anarchy in the State. They're listening to experimental piano music together, and it's such a beautiful cartoon of what an upper class yuppie couple would be like.
Officials close to the investigation are keeping tight-lipped as it may involve a high-ranking mafia member.
Oh my god.
Where's that detective's number?
On the fridge.
Those lying cocksuckers. Where on the fridge?
On the fridge, on the fridge!
Where on the fucking fridge?
I knew it! But you had to be the big man!
And this episode has a lot of big laughs with the Hollywood plotline. I find the Pussy plotline very tragic. My heart broke for poor Pussy when he was just bawling in the bathroom and the FBI was listening to him because he is facing 30 to life for dealing heroin. And so he's working with the FBI, but he feels this intense emotional bond to Tony. He's literally the confirmation sponsor. And kind of the emotional climax of the episode, or for this plotline, is him giving a spiel to AJ about what kind of a great man Tony Soprano actually is as he's wearing a wire. And you see this pressure just cooking him where he threatens to murder his family. The domestic scene. And one of the final scenes of the episode is him just bawling uncontrollably in the bathroom. He feels so much shame that he can't even be in the confirmation photo with AJ and Tony and Carm. And his FBI informants are listening to him cry. Brutal. Poor Pussy.
It's one of the only people that Tony isn't alienated from is Pussy. And now now it's going to be severed by the state, and he's going to lose one of the last people he actually feels like a brotherly kinship with.
I also love that in terms of the visuals, there's a scene where he's taking up time in the bathroom because he can't psych himself up to actually put the wire on. He needs to shave his chest hair. Thank you, representation of Harry, of Harry hirsute chested men. But he does it quickly because his wife is trying to get in the bathroom, and he cuts himself and he throws a shirt on, he throws the recording device in the hamper or whatever. And that's when he threatens, he's like threatening to kill or beat or whatever. And the blood seeps through from his skin through his wife beater. And it's like, oh, he has like a bleeding heart, right? It's right where his heart would be is where the blood is seeping through. And it's like such a nice little, you know, hey, if God's in the details, fucking take me to church, you know? It's the fucking Hozier song.
Yeah. So I'm going to start our discussion on existentialism, American existentialism, specifically at the end of this D-Girl explanation, because D-Girl talks about existentialism in those terms. AJ is studying it at school. He's been assigned...
I'm studying absurdism. I want to make that point. Camus isn't a punk bitch like fucking South.
Both of those guys are name drop on this episode.
As well as Nitch, as AJ calls him.
And I think that a big through line for this season is that life is boring and suffering unless you assign meaning to things. Unless you say, hey, all of this is dumb. Tony talks about this. He watched a movie and he's like, I didn't care. I watched Seven. I'm like, who gives a shit, right? And his therapist says, you're right. It doesn't matter how the movie ends. Unless you assign meaning to something, none of this matters. And so I think that that's what this season is about how life is meaningless unless you artificially give it meaning. It's the only way to live your life, because otherwise it's just a series of events until you die. That death is the only certainty.
Yeah.
And Ben, you mentioned there's this quote from Nietzsche in this episode that God is dead, right? And Ben, you said that the rest of this quote is usually left off.
Yes.
Right?
God is dead and we have killed him. Everyone knows that. And then it's a lament. It's what can we do to atone for this murder? It's not meant to be a celebration. It's meant to be a warning. Because Nietzsche saw that God had to be killed and replaced with culture and philosophy, right? Nietzsche wrote a lot about opera. He thought the stakes of opera were very high because it's going to replace God in our society as well as philosophy and, you know, the fucking Dionysian or whatever. Art, culture, philosophy. This is what we're going to replace God with. And what he was most concerned about, Nietzsche, in the late 19th century is that instead of replacing it with these three good things, we were going to replace God with nationalism and mindless consumerism. Wham, wham. He was right. He didn't write good enough. If he would have written better, he could have stopped us and saved us.
Wow, that's so prescient from Nietzsche.
One thing that I love about The Sopranos, it's an incredibly funny show, but it's also an incredibly bleak show in a lot of ways. Because I think if you ask a lot of people, what is the shortcut to a meaningful life? What's the easiest way to give your life meaning? Is to have a child or children or a family, right? Because you are now responsible until you die for like keeping these people like healthy and happy and whole and safe and passing on your values and morals. And if you're a weird evolutionary psycho, your fucking genes. Tony has this. He has a family that, if anything, it doesn't ascribe meaning to his life. It makes him feel worse half the time.
Yeah, and instead of investing his meaning in his family, he seeks distractions, drug affairs, things that are tantalizing temporarily until they too become boring. He breaks up with his Guma in this season because he gets bored of her eventually too. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you're right, Ben. There's a season where he's like, I want to be a better father to AJ, right? But the second that that's uninteresting or not easy, he gives up on it.
Yeah.
And he does the bust out instead.
Yeah, and that's part of the quote that Meadow says in this episode. It's like, your choices are boredom or suffering. If you care about something at all and you throw yourself into it, inevitably you're going to hit the wall of, I can't do this, or I can't do this easily. To care about something is to eventually open yourself up to suffering, right? And so, yeah, Tony is not down for that. He'd rather be bored than suffer.
Yeah, and we see Tony be very bored in this season. There's this great episode called House Arrest, where Tony has to stop hanging around with the mafia guys and just be a normal dude for legal reasons. And he starts to behave like an animal who's in captivity. He gets a rash from just like scratching at himself. He has to like spend time at the office. His life is as cushy as it could get. He makes a basketball pool. He fucks a coworker.
Oh yeah, the evangelical coworker.
Yeah.
That was amazing, where he's like, oh yeah, she's an evangelical. Let me take a shot. It's like, challenge accepted, motherfucker.
But yeah, all of this stuff bores him. And then we get one of the best Soprano scenes ever at the end of this episode. It is one of the best slice of life scenes where Tony comes back to Satriale's and the guys are just shooting the shit, right? Paulie's talking about moisturizers and Tony, he applies this like shoe polisher to his rash and you feel that sense of relief of finally scratching the itch of ennui. And this is also a pretty mundane situation at Satriales, but Tony has assigned meaning to it. He likes this. He cares about this. When Tony leaves the building and says, tell him no speeding in the neighborhood, he is romanticizing and assigning meaning to the idea of the neighborhood that he's the boss of. Then he starts talking about the game the previous night. His activities at Satriales are just as boring and mundane as the ones at the office, but at Satriales, he gets to think of himself as some Don figure. And there's a lot of allusions to this sort of boredom situation and being trapped in purgatory. This is also an episode where Uncle Junior gets his hand caught in the sink for 6 hours of the garbage disposal, you know, much like Tony being at the garbage disposal building. And it's also very similar to Polly's vision of what purgatory is, an existential hell of waiting and boredom. A lot of the subplots are driven by a sense of existential dread and boredom. There's this subplot of what I call the Jizz Aqua plot, Matthew Bevilacqua and Sean Gismonte. They're two guys that are young and trying to come up, but they are impatient. They went to Pace College, and so now they have other options, and they're feeling angst about being low-level guys, and they end up doing an incredibly stupid move and getting themselves killed. The entire Davy Scatino plotline is driven by this sense of ennui and boredom. Davy Scatino is a regular guy who is not happy with life, and so he gambles to feel a rush and eventually loses everything because of it.
Yeah, I think it's such a great send-up of American culture generally, because if anyone should be optimized to have a happy life under the conditions that we've set of American consumerist capitalism, surely it should be the gangsters, right? They are affluent. They have wealth. They are not bound by the law by virtue of their criminal gangsterism. There are literally no confines on their life, from work to laws, whatever.
No wives or daughters. Come on now.
Man. Yeah. Yes. Well, no wives or daughters that they care about. Mm-hmm. So the idea is, like, these people should be able to do whatever the fuck they want, and presumably that would make them happy, but it doesn't. And here's actually a wild fact that I learned recently. If you have a flock of sheep and there is no pen, no shepherd, you know what they do? They don't wander. They huddle together for warmth out of sheer terror when there's no guardrails whatsoever. If you put some kind of pen that they can see, the sheep start to wander and the sheep start to explore. Like, you need some kind of guidelines in order to grow and self-actualize. And these guys have none of them.
Yeah. And there's just this sense of angst and unhappiness that cannot be explained. And it's driven by, I think, the fact that Tony is alienated from everybody. And what do I mean by that? I mean, he lives on a house on a hill that he needs to drive anywhere to get to, that he has no family he can really confide in. He has no friends that he feels especially close to. The one that he has, he basically has a nervous breakdown because he realizes he's a snitch.
Yeah, his house is a fucking fortress, right? It's a castle. There's literally guns hidden around the place. Yeah. The profound irony of coming from the fucking mafia and lacking community. It's so ironic.
Well, right? It's good to get on the ground floor or something, you know? He had his people.
He did, and he probably grew up in a much less nicer house, but he was in a neighborhood surrounded by people he knew and was like, and now he has created, yeah, a fortress for himself to be by himself in. There is something to this idea of having more space to yourself that maybe is unhealthy for him. The mafia draws power from this kind of tribal organization, you know, this community aspect. Racketeering is easier if you're doing it to someone you know. And he's trying to now be the mafia in a suburban situation where he has no ties to anyone.
Yeah, ban all cars. Andre, I got anything you want to say on existentialism before we move on?
No, yeah, I mean, you already covered it, and it was really great. And I can say this because I basically invented existentialism, so you did a great job summarizing. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Thank you. One must imagine Tony Soprano happy.
Yeah, Al, anything else you want to say about existentialism, Sartre, assigning meaning?
Well, on the absurdity, I think, in terms of the way this episode ends with the kind of, you have to choose one family or the other, it's that, in some senses, meaning is about choice and like what you choose to assign meaning to. And for people who live in this kind of world, you know, whether it's trap films or mafia films, one trope is like the thoughtful character gets got first, or in some like tragic way, it could be like D'Angelo from The Wire. And I think this really kind of underscores Chris's choices in a really clear cut way, where he's like having an affair, but also he still ultimately chooses what is his family and community in kind of like a very specific way. So I think it's about meaning and choice, is a sense.
You mentioned absurdity. Yeah, because that's something AJ says in this episode. episode. I mean, he's quoting Camus, but he says life is absurd.
Yeah. You know, we've got the inventor of existentialism on the podcast, so we might as well talk about this. In all seriousness, like, for existentialism versus absurdism, like, I think the question between Saltz and Camus is, Camus would view, like, when you wake up every morning, your choice not to kill yourself is you assigning meaning to life. Whereas Saltz would say it's more material than that. And, like, Camus' analogy for life is Sisyphus pushing a boulder up a hill. And in the sense, I think Chris is trying to, you know, run up that hill and he gets pushed down to the bottom, is one of the ways you could look at this as well, in kind of an episodic arc.
And then I think for Chris is interesting because there's an element of choice in there, but at the same time, he's also rejected by the Hollywood people. There's also a sense in which his life is kind of on a track, on like a very like almost predestination track where, yeah, they steal all of his ideas to color commentate their gangster picture, but they actually don't want him as anything more than a curiosity.
You can see it in the framing of that episode. When we look up at Chris at the beginning of the episode, they're looking up at him, they're interested, they have a curiosity. And by the end of the episode, she's literally three stairs higher looking down on him, saying references to him that are clearly going to go over his head. She's like, this is a very William Inge moment.
Yeah, because those Jews at the Ivy League, they have a good thing going on.
They have their own Cosa Nostra over there.
No, I mean, that was really funny too, where it's like kind of upper middle class Jewish culture meeting New Jersey Guinea culture, and that whole dynamic with the Amy Sophia Chris affair. And it's kind of like she went down the spectrum of like greasy Jersey guys to like the Wish.com mobster to the real deal with Chris.
Maybe we could go to race then first, and I could go back to spirituality. Yep. So yeah, so we'll switch over to a little bit of a race wars here.
Come on, man.
Race talk. It's always funny because The Sopranos is so forward thinking on almost everything. You know, we talked about it last time, therapy, toxic masculinity, gentrification, all things that they got to seemingly decades ahead of the rest of culture. Pussy even uses the line positive vibes only this season, which just seems like decades ahead of the culture.
Gotta stay positive, right?
Positive vibes only.
But the Italian-American discussions in this show are the one thing that seems retrograde and the one issue that will become decreasingly relevant as time goes on. This idea that anti-Italian discrimination exists at all. This show, I don't know if it takes it seriously, but it gestures to it a lot.
In the 1990s,
yeah.
Let's be clear. They think that there is serious structural anti-Italian racism in 2000.
And I experienced it, all of it.
Tony, I love that he has this quote about, like, he justifies his position as a mob leader by saying, hey, listen, the Anglos, they have their JP Morgan Chases, and this is what we have, you know?
I'm sorry, just one last thing. You can't even imagine how it feels like to be fetishized by American women, right? So I know what I'm talking about.
Well, I think that's actually an interesting pair to split, where I think the Nancy Pelosi universe of, like, Italians are still oppressed, The Sopranos, like, kind of flippantly laughs at that. But at the same time, the cultural commodification of what is Italianness, like, I don't know, I'm just speaking with Andrea here, like, I think we all have met the bougie white girl who went to Tuscany and now lemon desserts are her favorite thing ever that she'll pay like $30 a unit for in fucking Santa Monica. So I think that that is actually an interesting thing where the cultural structural stratification stuff that Italians experience is more related to like class relationships and kind of food networkism and culture vulture shit. And I think that's like a point The Sopranos actually does make quite earnestly.
Yes, I like whenever they talk about class in Italians, I always find that those I can receive more because Amy Shafir is engaged to Chris's cousin, presumably another Italian, but it's the class difference that she really has a problem with.
I can have a quick sidebar about white women who go to Tuscany. A few months ago, there was a great Instagram scandal of one of these travel influencers went to the Amalfi Coast and posted just a million stories complaining about how many steps there were. She couldn't get an Uber. She couldn't get a Lyft. She had to walk. Fuck you. You have a fake job.
Disgrazia.
Every single influencer and TikToker who put the Amalfi Coast on my For You page over the last 2 months deserves jail time. Because while they showed you the gorgeous coastlines and the cute little towns, what they didn't tell you were the disclaimers. First of all, it's impossible to get here. You have to fly into Naples. Then you have to take a train from Naples to Sorrento. Then you have to stand in 90 degree weather waiting for a ferry to get on a ferry with all of your luggage. Then there's no cars driving. So you have to walk up 160 stairs to get to the top of this gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous area with these beautiful views.
But yeah, the complaint about The Sopranos often is that there are no people of color on this show. There's like a few black characters early on this season in a very ham-fisted episode, and it's not a great episode. I generally will forgive The Sopranos of this because it's not that there are no non-white characters on the show. There are no non-Italian characters on this show.
Well, what about you now? Non-Italian, non-Jew. Those
yes.
Are the two.
I counted. I went through and I counted all of the recurring characters in season two that were not Italian-American. There are 8 non-Italian characters in this season. 6 of them are Jewish. So the only 2 non-Italian, non-Jewish characters on the show are Agent Harris, who is an FBI agent. He represents the state, the Anglos, and his Russian girlfriend slash former dancer at the bank.
I think she's Kazakhstani.
Right, yes.
She's a Filipino.
This all makes sense to me, though, because it's just about Italians and Jews. We're God's favorite, right?
So... You're certainly your mother's favorite. There's even a quote in this season where Paulie mentions that Tony might have to go on the lam out to Elvis country. Furio says, what is Elvis country? And Paulie says, anywhere where there are no Jews or Italians. I'll put this in the show notes, but I did put together a data map of where Elvis country is based on that description. And yeah, Michael Madsen, you guys know Michael Madsen, the character actor?
Yeah, he's in Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah, oh, yeah, he's the psycho. He got mad at David Chase for not casting him in The Sopranos. He was like, I want a job on the Sopranos. I'm a gangster, you know, let me in. And David Chase was like, no, one, you're not Italian and you're from Chicago. And everybody in this show is from the New York area and most of the time Italian. It was a show that was very much committed to a verisimilitude.
Speaking of things 25 years ahead of their time, this is some woke casting right there. You can only play your specific identitarian background.
But they do subscribe to the rule that Italians and Jews are allowed to play each other. Okay, so final theme, just to quickly go over it from this season, spirituality. There's an episode that specifically talks about this, From Where to Eternity, written by Michael Imperioli, I believe, actually. And it's their most spiritual episode yet. You know, we've been talking about existentialism and the issues that come with no longer being religious. And in this situation, Chris almost gets killed. The world becomes a little bit more spiritual. It features visions of the afterlife, of ghosts and superstition. Paulie sees a psychic in a very, very funny scene.
Paulie sees a medium, and the medium starts calling him out for specific details of murders he's recently committed.
He wants you to know.
What the hell's the matter?
No, please, go on. I understand.
Who the fuck are you talking to?
Kind spirit. Is your name Sonny?
How the fuck do you know that?
He says he was your first, but I feel many more.
Hey!
That one's laughing. Poison ivy? He wants to know if it still itches.
Don't fuck with me. Who you been talking to?
I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to leave.
Why? What the fuck are they saying?
You really want me to say it?
Fuck you and this bullshit. That's what this is, you know. Satanic black magic. Sick shit.
I'm asking you to leave, sir.
Fucking quiz!
And then Chris wakes up from being recovering and being like, yeah, so I like went to hell. And it takes Paulie's weird Catholicism, but let's be serious here. It's like Italian Catholicism for Paulie's just paganism. Like, let's not split that fucking hair with those weird grannies in the South. But basically, it takes his conception of the devil and karma from reprisals of your sins, like somewhat seriously.
Yes.
As a plot device.
Chris visits hell and he describes it as an Irish bar where it's St. Patrick's Day every day.
So good.
But I think this episode is interesting because Paulie, as we've seen, he has the least amount of existential ennui, right? And I think it's because he is the most religious person on the show. And I don't mean that in the sense that he's the strictest Catholic. I just think that he has the strongest sense of a spiritual world existing, that an afterlife does exist, and I should be concerned about it.
Yeah, we had the line in the first season where an amazing Paulie line where the Gen X Chrissy asked him, you ever worried that nothing good will ever happen to you? It's like, yeah, it never did. You know? That is a fucking Sisyphean hero right there. That man is smiling, pushing up the boulder, and when the boulder rolls back down the hill, he goes, see that boulder, Tone? I just push up the hill, just roll back down, Tone. That's a terrible Paulie impression.
It's hard to do Paulie, man. See that boulder, Tone?
That's yeah. Beavis and Butthead, dog.
Yeah, Paulie wakes up at 3 o'clock in the morning. 3 o'clock, a reoccurring motif on this show. It's the hour that Jesus died, with nightmares that he is going to hell. And he goes to his priest and says, hey, I've been paying you protection money to the priests. and you don't have me covered.
Dude, Pauly would thrive in medieval Europe. He's literally talking about indulgences.
And in the AJ confirmation episode, we obviously have other discussions about spirituality and religion. And it's very ironic because Tony wants nothing more than for his kids to get an education, right? That's what this is all about. And as soon as AJ starts to learn about existentialism, he's like, what the fuck? Fucking internet.
What are they teaching them in school?
Yeah. And it's like, this is what an education looks like. And when AJ says, why were we born? His Catholicism has very little to offer him. I think Carmela just says, because of Adam and Eve. That's why.
Yeah. I love both of their reactions to him saying God is dead, because they both at the same time go, hey.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Hey, I remember every blowjob I ever got. How about you? It might be your first blowjob.
Yeah, of course.
How long did it take for the guy to come? Did you hear that? I said, you remember your first blowjob? He said, yeah. I said, how long did it take for the guy to come?
Alrighty, let's move on to closing thoughts. What does it mean to be a gangster at the end of history? I've been thinking recently that I came in at the end of history. It's going to be on the ground floor of an ideology. But there's this neoliberal idea that you can fix things by just making small incremental changes to something that might be flawed, right?
Structurally, systematically flawed.
And ultimately, that's what Melfi sees in Tony. Melfi thinks that he's only a few years of therapy away from incremental changes to his personality that will fix him. What she's ignoring is the gaping hole in his humanity that exists.
Yeah, this man who, as the shakedown is happening, we hear the gunshots, we hear the scream. He's sitting in his car with a big shit-eating grin on his face. And Dr. Melfi's like, what if we had him say 5 affirmations every morning when he woke up?
How does that make you feel?
She literally says, how does that make you feel?
Yeah, he's like, I was in my car while one of my guys was busting up a whorehouse when you called. And she's like, how does that make you feel?
Again, a show about therapy that dunks on therapy.
And Tony is a gangster who is increasingly working with, like we said, affecting the stock market, affecting the algorithm of global finance, finding ways to leech off of globalization. And he bemoans that his guys are modern Americans like himself and have no honor. And when he gets a guy in his crew that just did 10 years without snitching, his first reaction is to kill him. And at the same time, all of his headaches come from having a bourgeois family at this time. His daughter needs to launder his wealth into class status in the college system, which his wife can try to bully there, you know, like him with the Wobistic scam.
I want you to write that letter.
And his son suffers from the existential ennui that affects most young people living in capitalist realism. Meanwhile, because of the erosion of the public sphere, this means that any familiar ties that used to bind the mafia together with some kind of community are gone, and the mafia exists in this alienated society.
Yeah, everyone's just an atomized individual in the mob. You just do your own thing. And frequently, a lot of the problems that they face are due to people, like, just doing their own thing, going off script, not following orders. Everyone is truly an individual in the most fucked sense of the word. Dude, we don't live in a society.
Cool. Any closing thoughts from you guys?
I think one of the big things about The Sopranos season 2 is, you know, coming back to Richie and authenticity in the self, is that Richie is kind of what Tony thinks he could and should be in some senses, and that's part of why there's so much insidiousness. You know, obviously Richie's a piece of shit, but I think that it's kind of like he's this physical manifestation of Jackie Aprile, who actually did the time, who did the years, who has that kind of old school respect Tony wants. And, you know, I know we didn't cover it, but the members only jacket, I think, is really a metaphysical totem in the season, where it's like Tony doesn't put on that members only jacket. And he, for all his, you know, nostalgia, when we back in the day shit talking, he's not about that life in a very real sense. He's a whiny suburban guy who wants to do therapy, kind of like the FBI agent turning Pussy Bompensiero is like, yeah, he's a suburban yuppie living in North Caldwell.
You know, one thing that I was thinking about, how would The Sopranos look like if the show were shot nowadays? It says though, like, they managed to encapsulate and show some strands that you're talking about the end of history, and that's a very specific terminology you're using, right? Francis Fukuyama, post-Cold War, the new world order, you know, liberal democracy triumphing everywhere, the market is gonna arrange our international relations and so on and so forth. But then
that wasn't true, right?
I think part of the whole capitalist realism is that I think it would be very similar today, except everyone has smartphones and everyone's just even more alienated. I saw Slavoj Žižek on a fucking Instagram reel talking about like the next iteration after the end of history, liberal democracy with free markets. Slavoj Žižek was asked, who are they going to be building statues of in 50 years? And he's like, oh, the president of Singapore, the one who founded their system of authoritarian capitalism. Like, that is the next evolution. It's these market forces are here to stay. It's the liberal democracy that's going to go away. I don't know how that would affect a Sopranos written now. I don't know what Sopranos in Hungary or Singapore or one of these like slipping into autocracy countries would look like.
We just celebrated the 25th anniversary of The Sopranos. This is the same stuff that's happening. The cultural context has changed very little compared to 25 years before The Sopranos premiered in the mid-70s. I don't think it's changed that much, and that's why the show is still so beloved. I think I'm stealing this joke from Reddit, but if The Sopranos were made today, it would be so ridiculous. You know, it would be like Tony would be like in therapy. He'd have anxiety, depression. His kids would be social justice warriors. There'd be a gay mobster. You know, it couldn't be made today. It'd be so bad. Yeah, Adriana would have IBS. And I've been thinking about this end of history era in those terms a lot recently because I've been listening to the podcast Michael and Us, which a fan turned me on to. So yeah, thank you for that suggestion. Just to wrap up, Jacques Lacan is name dropped in this season, who is a post-structuralist theorist. And post-structuralism believes that a text does not have a single purpose or a single meaning, and instead that there are an infinite number of individual meanings and existences for a given text based on the reader who's reading it. And so this is our interpretation of this text. And The Sopranos, I think, more than maybe any other fiction I've encountered, opens itself up to post-structuralist readings because it is just so dense that you can look at it and take what you want from it. You can watch the show and be like, I like The Sopranos because Tony's the friggin' boss. And he's me. I want to be like him. I want to fucking say what I mean and fucking don't take any bullshit. But then you can watch it like Ben and I and be like, wow, they're silent. Silencers really underscore their place in society. It really is like you can take whatever you want from it.
It's abundant, like Shakespeare.
Yeah, like Shakespeare, right? Yeah, when I finished The Sopranos, I felt what Aristotle says about tragedy, that kind of catharsis. And I'm not joking. I feel like the experience of watching it, it has changed my life to an extent, just as Aeschylus or stuff like that. And I've never felt something like that with a product on screen, right? In movies or TV shows. I feel like The Sopranos really plays a different sport. And you know what's funny? In Italy, most people don't even know about it. I think that that's funny.
Yeah.
We are a minority over here.
Just like the P2 Lodge.
Come on, dude. They do, eh? Speaking of the post-structuralist reading, how you can read this abundant text in so many different ways, I was shown by the algorithm today a reel, which was a scene of Tony Soprano in therapy with Dr. Melfi talking about how he said, I know I'm prone to depression, but I pass that on to my children. And the original poster, it was by one of these pages that's like success quotes or something. He said, watching this as a father myself changed my life. Like the implication being that when Tony shows some kind of contrition that he's passed on through his genes, his toxicity, this is an example of the unconditional love of a father. And I'm like, you are watching this show so bad. We need to start issuing licenses for watching TV so that you need to pass some kind of exam before the state allows you to watch The Sopranos.
No, Ben, this is one of the great post-structuralist readings of The Sopranos, is that Tony is correct. That's one of the interpretations, is that everything Tony says is sincere and felt by the creators and wants you to take them that way.
Yeah, I feel like post-structuralists love to talk about positionality, you know? How does your position with respect to the text affect how you read it? And I guess that position is moron. Is the position that you're taking.
That position is right friggin' here. I got a fucking post-structure for you right here, pal. Why don't you post-modern these nuts? How about that?
Maybe something with deconstruction.
Deconstruction. Hey, pal, I'm in the union. You don't deconstruct anything without form and present. All right. Well, on that note, should we wrap it up? Ciao. Arrivederci. Thank you for joining us. As always, fucking leave a rating if you know what's good for you.
Like, subscribe.
The Bullshittish Podcast told you you're going to leave a rating, so you're going to leave a rating.
Hell yeah.
It's free.
Really helps out the fucking pod.
We're juicing the fucking Spotify algorithm.
Nice.
It's a pump and dump scam we're running here. Yeah. Do you have anything you want to plug, Andrea?
Anything you want to promote?
I just want to promote my beautiful self. So if you, by any chance, end up coming over either to the city of Milan, which I am blessed in with my presence right now, or, you know, if you want to come over to Italy, just, like, you know, shoot me a message and I'll help you out with everything.
Yeah.
I know this fucking country fairly well.
Al, anything you want to plug?
Just the Smithsonian. It's a great series of museums. Not one museum. Many museums that you can be in for days. So I like a sampler pack. What can I say? It's like a flight of American history.
Hell yeah. All right. As always, thank you for listening. Ciao, ciao. Have a good one.
Yeah. Conte partiro.
Anyway, $4 a pound.